This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on the show on Mardi Gras Day, we'll visit with LSU scientist and researcher Ivar van Heerden after nearly 8 years of being on the sidelines after being summarily dismissed by LSU. Dr. van Heerden has reached an agreement with the university on a settlement, and we will talk with him about his eight-year odyssey. And after Katrina, he was making statements that apparently the university did not like. We will talk with him about this amazing process and how it came to conclusion yesterday with a settlement in federal court. Also, author Ruta Sepetys, her book is about 1950s New Orleans, Out of the Easy. Now the news on 89.3 WRKN. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing today on Mardi Gras Day. And hope you're having a great Fat Tuesday. And we're spending it for most of the hour with Dr. Ivar van Heerden. He was head of the LSU Hurricane Center and, of course, was the face and the voice most often seen and heard after Katrina. And in December of 2005, Dr. van Heerden alleges that LSU tried to fire him unsuccessfully, that Governor Blanco intervened and saved his job. But then ultimately in 2009, on the 9th of April, LSU announced it would not renew Ivar van Heerden's contract, effective at the end of the spring semester 2010. That resulted in litigious action, and yesterday it came to a culmination in federal court here in Baton Rouge as Dr. van Heerden and LSU reached a settlement, and obviously Dr. van Heerden is not capable of talking about the terms of the settlement, but he can talk about the odyssey that began 8 years ago when he was essentially doing his job, talking about what was happening during and after Hurricane Katrina. Good morning to you, Ivar van Heerden.
Good morning, Jim.
Did you celebrate last night?
Yes, my wife and I, to celebrate some and then watch some good movies.
Well, you've had a long odyssey, as noted, almost 8 years when your job was on the line as a result of speaking your mind. And were you surprised at the reaction at LSU at that time and in the years after?
To some extent, no. I'd been at odds with LSU administration before on some controversial issues that they thought were controversial. After I had been down and seen the 17th Street breach and some of the others, I came back to my home and that night spoke to my wife and said, I need to speak out, but I fear this will cost me my job. You know, are you willing to take that risk? And she said, yes.
297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757, or you may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Now, Dr. van Heerden is portrayed by many as being a brave man. He risked his job and his livelihood and his reputation to speak his mind, but others have viewed him as somewhat of a maverick and a troublemaker. I'm sure you're aware of your complex reviews by depending on who's doing the reviewing.
Yeah, I mean, 99.9% have been positive, and that's been across the world. I mean, I was stopped just a few months ago in the little town of Plockton in Scotland, which most people have never heard of, and some guy said, "You're the Katrina guy, you know, thank you, the voice of truth," and so on. A lot of the maverick stuff a lot of the negative stuff that appeared on the internet, we now know originated from the Corps of Engineers. So there were Corps of Engineers personnel who were using government computers and government time and posting negative stuff. So,
well, the American Association of University Professors censured LSU last year over the firing of Dr. van Heerden. The organization represents several thousand members, over 50,000, ruling that Ivar van Heerden lost his job for speaking out against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. What did you say?
Well, it became very obvious very early. In fact, on the Tuesday after the flood, which was on Monday, that while the Corps of Engineers was claiming this was an act of God and it overwhelmed their levees, we knew from our storm surge models that the water had certainly at 17th Street and London Avenue hadn't got high enough to go over the levees. So I then went to Governor Blanco's staff and told them that I believed that there was something else going on here. Terry Ryder then said to me, "Ivor, go and find out. Just keep it quiet, but go and find out. And whatever you need, let me know." So then we proceeded to go and look at the levees. We had access to all the sites just about. And then on the 21st of September, we brought a reporter from the Washington Post to New Orleans and showed him, and he then wrote a story which appeared above the fold in the Post, and where we articulated that we thought the breaches were due to catastrophic structural failure.
This was September 21st, 2005.
That's correct. Yeah.
Basically 3 weeks after Katrina.
Yeah, it became very obvious to us. I mean, this wasn't my first experience with levees. I've worked on levees elsewhere in the world, so I knew what to look for, and it became very obvious to us that there must be either design problems or geotechnical engineering issues.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Dr. Ivor Van Heerden. Yesterday he reached a settlement, and the terms, of course, are undisclosed, but he has ended his fight with LSU, and LSU has ended its fight with him. And did you shake hands on the courthouse steps?
No. This was done via email.
Via email. I like the old way better.
Yeah, I started, Jim, right from the beginning. We wrote to LSU and said, look, we don't have to go to trial. There's a way to settle this. And last year in July, I did an interview with Reveille, and I stressed that I wanted to see healing, not conflict.
Veronica in Denham Springs. Good morning, Veronica. You're on the air with Dr. Van Heerden.
Hi. Why weren't you protected under whistleblower status?
I was, and that was one of the rulings that came from the judge during the process. He concluded, and I'm paraphrasing, that a reasonable observer would have concluded that the Louisiana whistleblower laws had been violated. So that would have been part of the trial, should we have gone to trial.
Why did you avoid the trial? You could have said, look, I want my day in court, but you decided to end this.
Well, again, I wanted to see healing, not conflict. I think LSU's really taken it on the nose, the AAUP, the negative press, there have been movies. But more importantly, I was concerned that we would get a lot of press. And right now, the state of Louisiana has finally got to the point where we could see the billions of dollars needed to restore the coast. So my fear was a lot of LSU bashing could turn into Louisiana bashing, and that could impact our funding in the future for the coast.
Your number is 297-5633, and Dr. Ivor Van Heerden is with us, native of Johannesburg, as you can probably tell from his melodious South African accent. One of the most youthful 62-year-old men you'll ever see. On the surface, it doesn't look like this has taken a tremendous toll on you, but I'm sure it has.
It did take a toll, and especially with my family. Partially because starting after Katrina, I was never home. I was constantly in New Orleans doing the research and then working late at night. And that continued all the way through until the end of the Mr. Go trial. So it had a big impact on my family. And then also the real concern of the future, how we were going to pay for college fees and so on. Both my daughters got so upset at Louisiana that they've left, and I think
how were you informed when you were fired? Did the chancellor call you in and tell you that you had to go, or what exactly happened?
No, I was called in by the interim dean of the College of Engineering, given a letter telling me that I'd basically been fired. And when we pressed why, I was told it wasn't performance, it wasn't budget, but we don't have to tell you why.
Mm-hmm. How close were you to being fired in 2005?
It's my understanding from the documents that we've seen that LSU had started the process to fire me in 2005. From what I've been told, they were actually looking for me to give me a letter and spoke to one of my research associates mm-hmm. who informed them that I was visiting with Governor Blanco. And I've since learned from reading Jed Horn's book that Governor Blanco did intervene, and she stopped that.
But you did not shy away. In fact, a year later, you were on this show, less than a year later, and in many other media stops, you talked about the same thing with the even more detail in The Storm, your book. Did that contribute to LSU's angst about your actions?
I'm sure it did. You know, just before the book came out, or just after the book came out, LSU wrote an editorial. I mean, used the editorial pages of the Times-Picayune and New York Times to question my expertise and my qualifications to be doing this work. And you know, that to me was a real attack on my credibility.
So that was 2006, and then boom, 2009, you're told that you're gone. And this was after 24 years at the university as a student and as a researcher. This is a big part of your life.
It was. And, you know, not only did I lose my job, but I lost access to the body of work that I had produced. I lost access to the researchers I had worked with. The graduate students that I had been funding, and of course the computer models, which were very, very important during Katrina and Gustav in terms of warning people of what was to happen.
Gary on Jefferson asks, at what point did you hire Jill Kraft as your attorney?
Originally, I met with some attorneys in Washington, D.C., whose expertise is in whistleblower, dealing with whistleblower issues, and we then contacted Jill Kraft. So she got involved very early, and I think we filed the suit in February of 2010.
February of 2010. Now we're in February 2013, so it's been almost an eight-year process since the heat was on, and a three-year process as far as getting your day in court and getting a settlement. The judge was Jim Brady. He ruled in some cases for you, in other cases against you. Were you satisfied with his conduct on the bench?
Yes, I was a little disappointed that he didn't rule that I had de facto tenure, especially after other groups had. But no, I think he hit the core issues, which was the Louisiana whistleblower violations and also the freedom of speech issue. And in one of his rulings, LSU had argued that I wasn't protected under through academic freedom, and he, in essence, strengthened academic freedom as we know it.
297-5633. We will take some more calls for Dr. Ivor Van Heerden, who had a big day yesterday, celebrated by watching movies. Were there libations involved as well?
Yeah, I opened a bottle of good South African wine.
I imagine maybe more than one.
Yeah. Well, it's just my wife and I.
And you're going back to South Africa to celebrate, aren't you?
Well,
at least for a little while.
Yeah, through this whole trial, one of the things that, I mean, this run up to the trial, one of the things that's been in the back of my mind is my sister has acute leukemia. She's in an isolation ward in South Africa, and I really need to be with her. So we will fly over before too long to spend time with her.
We will return with Dr. Ivor Van Heerden, head of the LSU Hurricane Center, and then canned in 2009. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Yesterday, Ivor Van Heerden had a settlement with LSU. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Happy Mardi Gras, and please be safe wherever you may be on Fat Tuesday. We're in studio for a while longer with Ivor Van Heerden, former head of the LSU Hurricane Center. He was a scientist at LSU for 18 years and was a graduate student for 6 years prior, and first began his trip to Tigertown in 1977, so that's 36 years ago. And yesterday, after an ordeal that lasted several years, Dr. Van Heerden reached a settlement with the university that will prevent a federal trial from taking place. Your suit had been described as a multi-billion dollar lawsuit. Is that right?
No, I don't know why that.
Are we visiting with a billionaire today?
No, definitely not. the suit wasn't anything about vengeance. It was more to make sure that this didn't happen again, to ensure that LSU recognized the value of academic freedom.
Ben Daly and Baker, good morning. You're on the air with Ivor Van Heerden.
Yes, good morning to you both. That was an admirable stance that the doctor had took. But I wanted to ask him two questions. Number one, was he on a tenure or non-tenure track route in terms of LSU? And number two, were there any folks within the Corps of Engineers that actually supported his findings? I'll hang up and listen.
To answer the first question, I was on hard money. I was on the machine-run budget. I believed I had tenure, so did LSU faculty and the AAUP. The judge disagreed. On the second question, I've had Corps of Engineers folk at book signings and meeting them in the road, in the street, say, thank you very much, you did the right thing. All of our research has, if you will, been upheld by that done by the National Science Foundation, the reports coming out of the American Association of Civil Engineers. Mr. Go, Mississippi River Gulf Outlet litigation, the judge ruled in the favor of the plaintiffs and before it went to appeals. So, no, our science was very, very good, and I made a point of making sure that before we put anything out, that we knew we had good data and that it was data that could stand up by itself.
What is your case in the process that has been involved over the last several years say to others who may have some sort of an issue with Louisiana State University? Do you think they'll be emboldened or frightened by what has occurred in your particular case?
Well, filing suit and then going through the deposition process and all of that, some people have equated it to having a root canal or a series of them. I believe personally that if you sincerely think that you've been harmed and that the university has made a bad choice, that you need to follow your conscience and go ahead. That was certainly what motivated me. I often say I want to, when I shave in the morning, I want to be able to look in those in my eyes in the mirror and be happy and proud with who I am. And I felt it was extremely important. There are going to be other Katrinas. There are going to be other major issues, and LSU is the flagship university, and its prevailing position shouldn't be that we don't support science and our researchers, but that we believe in academic freedom and they have the right to express themselves.
Does the settlement preclude you from ever working at LSU again?
That hasn't, as I remember,
so
been
you
part of it.
Potentially could go back to work there, as far as you're aware.
We have the LSU Hurricane Center is shuttered. It's not really operational. Dr. Paul Kemp, one of my co-workers and a good friend, and I have said that we would be willing pro bono to help the university get the Hurricane Center up again. So
that offer stands?
Yeah, we don't need to be paid. The state of Louisiana needs a viable, functioning Hurricane Center. It proved its worth 1,000 times over in Katrina and the afterwards.
297-5633. Still time to talk with Dr. Van Heerden if you so desire. Miriam in Inniswold writes, does Dr. Van Heerden think the delay in getting Dutch submersible pumps and Dutch technical crews to run them is a significant factor in the flawed federal response to post-Katrina flooding?
My comment would be, and the Dutch have complained to me many, many times. We work very closely with the Dutch in the Mr. Go litigation, that they haven't been invited to the table. And having spent some time in the Netherlands looking at their systems, I think when it comes to saving lives, ego shouldn't get into it, and we should look to get the best technology, the best equipment from wherever in the world it's available. And obviously, if the Dutch are still complaining about this, then we're not doing what we should be doing to protect lives.
Well, as you know, recently there was another report issued that indicates that the levee system in the United States is not really fortified to acceptable levels. What do you think?
One of the things that we showed during our research was that the Corps of Engineers weren't using realistic factors of safety. They were using very low numbers, 1.5 or 2, whereas in many parts of the world you use factors safeties 5 to 7, which means it's 5 to 7 times stronger than what you think the maximum load is going to be. So, yes, I wouldn't be surprised that there are levees throughout the U.S. that are in bad shape or under-designed, and unfortunately it's going to take a lot of money to correct those issues.
Well, the Corps report shows that 1,451 of the nation's 2,487 levees have been checked. Of those, 121 were deemed fully acceptable, but 1,004 were merely minimally acceptable, and 326 were in dire need of repair. So what does this mean as far as the amount of money that would be necessary to fortify these levees?
It's going to be billions, and those numbers indicate that only 10% of them are safe. We found in Katrina that over 50% failed. One way to look at this is, what has it cost the taxpayer to get New Orleans back on its feet in southeast Louisiana? It's cost hundreds of billions of dollars, far more than it would have cost to totally revamp those levees or to have built the levees to the right standards from the very beginning. We need to use the absolute best science that's out there, the best engineering practices, and the best technology.
There is a quote from you that is on a neighborhood memorial, I think, to this day in the Bywater section of New Orleans. Do you recall what that quote is?
I believe it was, if we could just get the money that they were spending in the war in Iraq, we could sort out the coast and the levees or something to that effect.
John O'Neill asks, can you name any colleagues who share your opinions?
I could go on for hours, but to start off with, if you look at the National Science Foundation team, Dr. Ray Seed, Dr. Bob B., they concurred. There were a number of American Society of Civil Engineers who concurred. Gordon Boutwell, who's since passed away from Baton Rouge, he was on the American Society of Civil Engineers team. He supported us. The list goes on and on. I've been invited to give talks all over the world, very often in engineering departments or engineering schools, and the compliments flow. So we got it right.
297-5633 for Dr. Ivor Van Heerden. He reached a settlement yesterday with Louisiana State University after a long court fight. That the settlement will make sure that there is not a trial, which Dr. Van Heerden says would have been divisive, and that was not his intent. Stephen in Central Highlands. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air with Ivor Van Heerden.
Hi, good morning, Jim. I wanted to say, Professor Van Heerden, my wife and I, We're graduates of LSU. She from the medical school and from the School of Agriculture, myself from the School of Geology and Law School. And you are a real hero to us. Your fight for free speech on the campus, academic freedom, and your integrity. You're a hero to our family, our children, too, who are going to LSU now. And we're celebrating over here, not just Mardi Gras. It's your fight, and we're so glad that it's settled. And just how you explained the settlement is just, once again, just...
Okay, I think we lost Stephen, but he's high on Ivor. I'm sure you're heartened by his comments.
Yeah, it brings tears to my eyes. You know, throughout this whole thing, I've had thousands and thousands of people thank us. Thousands wrote letters to the governor, to LSU, to our congressmen and senators. You know, there's just been an incredible amount of support, and it makes it really makes it all feel worthwhile. You know, we did the right thing, and I thank those folk from the bottom of my heart for their support.
A couple of questions. One from Laura. She asks, noting that your attorney was a very good one, Jill Kraft, what kind of legal firepower did LSU have at its disposal?
Well, it was David and Goliath. The LSU had at least two attorneys. There may have been more. They had the very deep pockets of the state. LSU doesn't pay the lawyers. LSU doesn't pay any settlement. It all comes directly from the state. So, they definitely had all the money they wanted and a strong team. Mm-hmm.
Were you deposed?
Yes, I was.
How uncomfortable or pleasant was that experience?
Well, it's like having a root canal. I've been deposed before, so I had some idea of what to expect. And the rule is you go in and just tell the truth, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Were there several attorneys asking you questions or just one?
No, just one.
Do you recall who it was?
I believe it was a Mr. Zimmerman.
And I'm sure he was quite thorough.
Yeah, he was.
How long did it last?
All day.
All day. All day. That is a tiresome activity for sure, but you survived it. And apparently LSU decided that this was not a winner or they would have gone to court. Not a winner for them.
Yeah, I can't speculate on why they decided not to continue to trial. I'd certainly indicated on more than one occasion I wanted healing, not conflict. I think everybody, my sense is that everybody realized that that this had the potential of really damaging the state and therefore the chances to get federal dollars. I mean, the question to ask is, right now when the Restore Act's been passed and there's going to be a lot of money come from BP, do we want to have a very public trial where one of the and better-known scientists in Louisiana is fighting the state, if you will, because he got fired?
Rachel inquires whether there was a political aspect to the reaction to your remarks.
Well, this is Louisiana. I know we from some of the emails that we saw, we did upset some of the big companies who do the work for the Corps of Engineers. They make political donations, so I'm quite sure there was a political aspect to it.
Well, the blame, if you will, for Katrina, as we know, is still being bandied about. Some folks blame President Bush and the Army Corps, and others blame Governor Blanco and Mayor Nagin. In your mind, what was the primary culprit?
If the levees hadn't have failed, we wouldn't be talking about Katrina. That's the bottom line. If the levees hadn't have failed. So who's responsible for the levees? The Corps of Engineers. Who was tasked under the 1965 Flood Control Act to build levees for the most for the strongest storm that they perceived could happen, and that was right after Betsy, which was a Category 4. You know, the Corps was given money, they were given their marching orders, and they just didn't do their job. And as a result, Katrina happened.
Okay. Now, all these years later, as you note, the Hurricane Center has been shuttered. There have been other significant budget cuts at LSU and on other campuses in Louisiana. What do you view as the situation right now as far as funding and commitment to higher education in Louisiana?
Well, I'm an academic, and so I firmly, firmly believe in the value of education, and especially now in this global market where we've seen a lot of good graduates coming out of China and India and elsewhere. In my opinion, we need to be funding higher education to the full extent possible. However, at the same time, we need to recognize that there may be efficiencies needed in how we manage some of the universities in Louisiana. So perhaps a combination of that. But I would hate to see higher education get cut and get cut to the point that our degrees from LSU no longer have the value that they do.
Well, I would think preparing for the trial that did not happen the last 3 years was a full-time endeavor for you. Now that that has been resolved, what's the next step for you?
Well, through all of this, one way I kept my sanity was my wife and I acquired an old sailboat, and we set it up in our backyard. And we spent 4 years refurbishing that sailboat. Last year, we took off 5 months and went sailing. The sailboat is sitting up in Virginia right now. You know, in a couple of months, we want to get back on the boat and do some sailing. I'm also working on a book. So now that we're free...
Will the book be about the trial?
No, although there is the potential of one about the LSU. No, the book's actually... a historic novel related to the spread of Christianity by the Irish in the fifth century.
That's a fascinating topic. A man of many interests is Ivar van Heerden, who spent many years at LSU. And what was your reaction that day you were called into a supervisor's office and given the word that you were no longer employed or would soon no longer be employed?
I suspected the week before, based on what I was hearing in the passageway, that this was coming. You know, it was a complete shock because there was going to be an annual review. I was now having to go through annual reviews. I knew that I had done all the work that was required of me to meet my performance. So it was an absolute shock, and especially when he said, when I was told it wasn't performance, it wasn't budget. Of course, then you suspect the worst of politics.
Well, congratulations on a settlement, and hats off to Ivar van Heerden for staying the course, and hopefully the next few years will involve productivity from this man of many talents. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
This is Jim Inkster. Happy Mardi Gras to you. Kevin Gallagher producing. 297-5633, your number, as always. You may reach us with email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we're joined by a fascinating lady who's written a compelling novel about New Orleans in the 1950s, Out of the Easy. And Ruta, before we begin, I want to make sure I have your pronunciation correct for your last name. Is it Sepetys?
Close enough. It's
Sepetys. Okay, Sepetys. Okay. Beautiful name from a writer of consequence who has chosen New Orleans as the backdrop for a fascinating story. Why New Orleans?
New Orleans is unlike any city in America. I mean, the cultural diversity is woven into the food and the music, even the local superstitions. And for an author, there are so much low-hanging fruit in New Orleans in terms of stories. It seems like there's a story, you know, in every dark doorway in New Orleans.
And New Orleans in the 1950s was a happening place. It still is. But It was a bigger city then, and some would say a more engaging city. You've done a lot of research about that time and place.
I did, and, you know, I'm fascinated by the time period of 1950. I have such a unique name because my father is from Lithuania, and he came to America in 1950, and I often wondered what it was like because, you know, there's such a high level of nostalgia associated with the 1950s. But when I was doing my research and peeling back the layers, what I found was a lot of pain and a lot of secrets. And that wasn't, you know, the impression that I originally had of, you know, post-war America. I thought we were living the American dream. But for many people in New Orleans, they were living the quiet nightmare. And so I wanted to capture that in a novel.
Our guest is Ruta Sepetys, and the number is 297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation. Her book is Out of the Easy, and it captures New Orleans in all its glory from over a half century ago. The Washington Post says few books are beautifully written, fewer still are important. This novel is both, and the New York Times commenting about Ruta's work very favorable and favorably in the magazine section this past Sunday. I'm sure you were pleased that your book got a review from the newspaper of record.
Absolutely, and so grateful.
Mm-hmm. And you followed this book with an outstanding, or it follows Between Shades of Gray, and Ruta got high marks for her work as a debut novelist. Now, the main character in Out of the Easy is Josie Morane. How did you create Josie?
I created Josie Morane through an experience working with young girls in a mentoring program, helping, you know, to teach decision-making skills. And in that program, I met young women who had been swept into the dysfunctional current that was their home life. But I also met young women who, despite being born into a very difficult situation and a difficult family, had made decisions to separate themselves in order to start a new life. And that inspired me. And those girls taught me that we can learn to fly even if we're born with broken wings. And the idea of that broken yet beautiful bird became the character of Josie Morane.
Well, she's 17 years old as the story begins, the daughter of a brothel prostitute, and she devises a plan to get out. And then what happens?
And then everything starts to go wrong. And as a writer, that's what you want to do. You want to push your character to a moral decision and then, you know, really, really have the ceiling fall in on them. And that's what happens. She becomes tangled in the murder investigation of a tourist in the French Quarter.
And you focus on the brothels, and New Orleans is a lively city, as we know, then and now. What's the fascination with the brothels of New Orleans circa 1950?
Well, I discovered a book called The Last Madam, A Life in the New Orleans Underworld, and it was written by New Orleans native Christine Wiltz. And the book chronicled the life of New Orleans Madam Norma Wallace. And I read the book in one sitting, and I was absolutely, you know, fascinated with every detail about not only this brothel culture, but the underworld that surrounded the culture. And it inspired me to create a fictionalized character, Willie Woodley, who is based on Norma Wallace. And I came to New Orleans, and the author, Christine Wiltz, really helped me with my research. I would not have been able to write the book without her because I'm originally from Michigan and now I live in Tennessee. And I don't think you can write truly about New Orleans or Louisiana unless it's in your DNA. And so I'm an outsider and I needed people to help me. And Christine Wiltz was one. And her book about the brothels is really what sparked this whole idea.
We're visiting with Ruta Sepetys, who has written Out of the Easy, the New York Times best-selling author of Between Shades of Gray. And Ruta, you are a young person, but you're off to a fantastic start in your writing career as a novelist. And I'm impressed, and I'm sure our listeners are, that you've chosen New Orleans as the backdrop for your story. And you do so right after World War II. As you note in the book and elsewhere, the time was a dream for some, but not so pleasant for others.
Definitely. And I love writing historical fiction. People say to me, well, Ruta, would you ever write commercial fiction? You might sell a lot more books if you wrote about, you know, vampires or paranormal or, you know, but no, I'm so intrigued with history. I think history holds secrets. And, you know, secrets can be exciting to discover. It's a bit like being a detective when you write historical fiction. But more importantly, through characters and story, suddenly these historical statistics, they become human, and we cheer for them, and we cry for them, and suddenly these people matter, and their history matters, and we learn about this history, and that's the power of books.
And you began your career in the music industry, didn't you?
Oh, I did. Okay, you've got the scoop. You've got the gossip on me. I did. For 22 years, I worked in the music industry, helping artists and musicians tell their stories through music. And I worked on reality television and on video games and had my own artist management company representing songwriters and musicians and crazy rock bands.
And how did that experience help you become the esteemed novelist that you are?
Well, it helped me constantly ask the question, what's the story here? What is the story? When I was working with these artists and musicians, let's say, as artists and musicians are known to do, one of them gets dragged off to jail, I had to learn to pull a story out of it for the media. And so I was constantly asking, what's the story? And one day, one of my clients turned to me and said, Ruta, for 20 years, you've been asking us, what's your story? We want to know, what's your story? And do you know, I didn't have an answer. But when I started thinking about it, that's what inspired my first novel, Between Shades of Gray. You know, my father escaped from Stalin and lived for 9 years in refugee camps, and his family was deported to Siberia. That was part of my story, and I decided to tell that in the novel Between Shades of Gray. So I think working in the music business has really helped me identify those stories.
Well, Ruta has spent many years in Los Angeles when she was in the music industry, but you live now in Tennessee, don't you?
I do. I live in Nashville, which also has a beautiful arts and music and literary culture. I'm so grateful to be here.
Well, as we know, New Orleans has a lot of arts and music and literary culture, and many, many of those aspects of the city are on display today on Mardi Gras Day. So this is an appropriate time to talk with an author who has a book about the Big Easy, Out of the Easy, Ruta Sepetys. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, our pleasure, and let's talk again. Take care. Happy Mardi Gras. Take care, Ruta.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Bye-bye. And as we continue along this morning, it is worthy of note that the governor has outlined in a memo to legislators his plans for raising the state sales tax nearly 2 cents per dollar, increasing the state cigarette tax by more than a dollar per pack, and eliminating severance tax exemptions. And this plan will be discussed with Ernest in the next several months, and lawmakers, of course, will review it with zeal at the legislative session starting in a few months. And it looks like now we have some meat on the bones as far as exactly what will be happening in 2013. And it is curious that the plan involves an increase in cigarette taxes. Remember, the governor was against a 4 cent renewal of a cigarette tax. And as a result, lawmakers did not buck the governor on that, and it didn't happen. But now we're talking about more than $1. And it is estimated that every time a cigarette tax is increased by one penny, it results in an additional $3 million in state income. State revenues. So if it's a dollar, that's $300 million that would be estimated or projected as the windfall for an increase on the cigarette tax. We're well behind other southern states at 32 cents a pack, and certainly behind New York State at $4.35 a pack in state taxes on cigarettes. So it looks like the governor has a reverse course on this, and it will be fascinating to hear how he frames it, because in the past, as we know, Governor Jindal has refrained from backing any so-called new taxes. Well, this is a new tax, but it does involve, if the governor gets his wishes, a decrease in other taxes, and he wants to completely do away with the state income tax. So this will be a huge undertaking by the legislature, and there will be public outcry in some cases, I'm sure, and public support in others, and that's what a legislative session is all about. Treasurer John Kennedy has stated that the plan will require legislative approval, two-thirds in both chambers, and then, according to Treasurer Kennedy, it would also require a vote of the people. Now, the Jindal administration is of a different mind. Apparently, it believes that if lawmakers approve it, two-thirds in both chambers, it's a done deal. Treasurer Kennedy says it must go to the voters. We'll see, and it would probably involve another court battle. And the governor has engaged in a few of those, as we know, on other endeavors that have been successful legislatively but have been stalled in the courts. And some conservative judges have ruled against this administration, notably Tim Kelly, a Republican whose wife, Angele Davis Kelly, was Governor Jindal's first commissioner of administration. Tim Kelly ruled that money from the Minimum Foundation program could not be used as vouchers to send kids from public schools to private schools. And the governor denounced the decision by Judge Kelly, but nonetheless, the judge ruled as he did, and he did so as a conservative Republican jurist. And that case is headed for the state Supreme Court, and it would seem that no matter what happens in the legislative session, that this would invite some kind of litigious activity, and we shall see what occurs. Representative Sam Jones, Democrat from Franklin, says he and about a dozen other legislators gathered in the mansion's dining room to hear the plan. And it is notable that Sam Jones was in on the discussion. He's not somebody who would be regarded as a natural ally of Governor Bobby Jindal. But Jindal administration officials presented a two-page outline and then collected the outline at the end of the meeting. But one legislator, according to The Advocate, in a story by Michelle Milholland and Mark Ballard, took a photo of it. And so the word is out that this would involve almost a 2 cent increase per dollar sales tax hike, and it would increase the state cigarette tax by more than $1 per pack, if the plan is enacted as expected. But the jury is out, and people like C.B. Fergoston are already saying the math is not workable, that it would require more tax dollars than this. And, of course, we will follow this story and cover it right here on WRKF and on this program in the days, weeks, and months to come. But this looms as the biggest issue in the state right now in 2013. And you never know what's going to happen in the world. And yesterday there was a bombshell first announced on Morning Edition in the early morning hours about Pope Benedict announcing his resignation. He'll leave at the end of the month, February 28th. And this in the holy season, of course. And as we know, in this community and in Louisiana, there are many Roman Catholics who will be affected in one way or another by the Pope's resignation, and this is somewhat unprecedented in modern time for a Pope to leave while he is still alive, but Pope Benedict has decided to do it, and there could be a new Pope, could be, by Easter Sunday, and hopefully we'll catch up with some people in the Catholic community. Perhaps Father Jeff Bai will come back for an appearance. I recall visiting with him on this station back in 2005, when Pope John Paul II died, and Pope Benedict was considered to be a controversial choice at the time. As a young man, he was part of the Nazi youth, and he became head of the Roman Catholic Church with over 1 billion, with a B, members across the world, and more than 2 million in the state of Louisiana. We will follow that story as well. And we will be back tomorrow, day after Fat Tuesday, for an Ash Wednesday presentation of this program. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, have a great holiday if you're out and about. If you're not, we appreciate you working on Mardi Gras Day. Until tomorrow, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.